Welcome back to the WFO Live podcast. Episode 66 brings us another interview with Dr. John Sullivan. This interview will cover research and controversy related to COVID-19. As usual, Dr. Sullivan always comes guns blazing with research and challenging assumptions. This interview is no different. I really enjoyed this interview because we went deep into multiple peer-reviewed journals and all kinds of research related to masks, COVID-19, and also conditions like atrial fibrillation and B vitamin deficiencies and many other points made about metabolic disease and how it relates to COVID-19. This one is a very deep interview, and I think many of you will find value in it. It will at least provoke thought. And I think of all things, that's what Dr. Sullivan brings to the table, the willingness to provoke thought and provide rational arguments for rational behavior. So with that, it's time for the bumper music. Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission. Okay, and we're recording. This is Dr. William Curtis with Future Focus Family Medicine, the WFO Life Podcast, and the Energy Tribe. Today I've got a familiar voice. He has the sultry radio voice from 1440 Keys, Keys to Health. I have Dr. John Sullivan on. He has been on our show multiple times, and so we welcome him back today. Going to talk about some maybe latest thoughts on COVID-19 and that type of thing. Everybody's got that on their mind. How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right. Glad to be here today.
Yeah?
I know COVID-19 is, boy, right now it's gotten to be such a crazy topic today, and we've got... It seems like it's gotten so politically motivated in so many areas and so many ways, and I kind of wanted to cut through some of that and get through the insanity. I've got myself, you know, we were doing a radio show together on 1440 Keys.
Right.
You kind of advocated that to me here recently. And you've gotten me in a lot of trouble.
You noticed that.
Yes, I've gotten in a lot of trouble with the medical establishment recently.
Oh, no. You're in trouble.
I don't know how that happens, but... I know I'm very critical of the medical profession and have been, but not of individual doctors. I know that you've always talked about the doctors down in the trenches.
Right.
I mean, they're just doing the best they can
right.
within the system that's been created, and they didn't create the system.
Right.
But I'm very critical of the medical profession, especially how they've handled this whole COVID thing. And I've gotten entrenched, and the reason I am critical of the medical profession, I've gotten in trouble with them myself here in recent, last year. I was on doing a TV interview, and I had mentioned that, well, before you take any medications and put any chemical substance into your body, and vaccines are a medication according to the CDC, mm-hmm. you should always have an informed consent from your doctor and find out what they're giving you and why. Well, I got a letter from the Texas Medical Association that was, which they were threatening to take legal action against me. Because they said I was practicing medicine without a license, and I had to get a lawyer to defend myself. Because apparently I wasn't allowed to say you should have informed consent before taking medications.
Yeah.
We made an agreement with them that I would no longer practice medicine without a license, so I'll try to adhere to that. Tell people, you don't have to have an informed consent, just, you know, let it...
Yeah, that's crazy, but given the fact that, you're basically asking that people talk to their doctor and just, you know, figure out, okay, what exactly am I being injected with?
It's interesting today, the medical profession, everyone says, well, you got to follow the science. We're all going to die. You have to do what science tells you. But who dictates what the science is and mm-hmm. what science is acceptable and what's not? And right. I think the federal government has used the medical association, and it's not the individual doctors, like I said, but these associations have now become so politicized.
Right.
It is ridiculous. So I do have a problem with the medical community as a whole because of that. And I think a lot of medical doctors have too in the past, and you've talked about going and taking board certifications, and a lot, hundreds of doctors are speaking up saying, hey, these answers are wrong, and these questions, that's not what the science shows, but I have to answer them incorrectly to get my certification.
Right.
And so the medicine is not always scientific. 85% of all medical procedures have no scientific basis in science. And but they hold themselves out. They're the ones running the show and dictating how life on this planet is lived right now. Whether people can have run their business or go to our children can go to school. And who are they to do that? I really have a problem with that. And a lot of advice we've been getting is not wrong, is not correct, and is not scientific. So I want to go over some of that today, kind of cut through some of the BS that's in that. And I got myself along those lines. I got myself in trouble because I was making fun of all these, this mask wearing, this mandate, and even politicians. Oh my God, what we should do is mandate mask wearing. And I'm going, wait a minute, wearing a coffee filter on your mask, you think is going to protect you from a virus that's a nanomicron big? Seriously? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a height of medical technology. We've been wearing masks since the times of the plague.
Right.
that's as far as medical technology has grown.
Right.
I mean, do we not remember back in 1918 during the Spanish flu epidemic? And incidentally, the Spanish flu didn't come from Spain. It's just that the Spanish reported on it. But people were mandated to wear masks then. And it didn't work. It had no benefit. So why do you think it has a benefit 100 years later? And I also indicated masks don't work because it says so on the box. When you look on the box of the mask, it says does not protect against infectious disease. So if it says so, and you look on any box, the mask, they said it does not protect against infectious disease. So why would they say that if it did?
And so, by the way, he's handed me a disposable protective mask, Safe Warrior. I guess it's some brand. And, 99% bacterial filtration, 3-layer construction. And then there's some warnings at the bottom. It's not a respirator. Shouldn't be used for paints, asbestos, silicone. Also says it could cause breathing difficulties and does not remove the risk of contacting any disease or infection.
On any mask, you look in the box,
that's
the warning on the mask.
Right.
We see that time and time again, and we see study after study. It says in Washington Post, everyone wore masks during the 1918 flu pandemic, and they were useless. The wearing of masks, the exhaled viruses will not be able to escape and will concentrate in the nasal passages and inner olfactory nerves, and that's written by Russell Blaylock, an article that he's published. Cloth masks are useless against COVID-19 is another article. And CDC coronavirus outbreak, and they talked about, they actually put out on their website, we'll talk about the research that shows masks have no benefit. You know, Dr. Fauci even said, well, he just wears it for symbolic reasons. But I got a doctor that called in the show. He was very upset. He said, oh, my God, I was being irresponsible, doctor, for saying this. He was on this, and it's a doctor I knew and know in town, and I have a good relationship with him, but he called in, and he was reading me the Riot Act and for getting in trouble again, and he was saying that he was on this committee, this advisory committee, and they had the top doctors and virologists and stuff, and they were making public policy, and they had this study from the New England Journal of Medicine, and the study showed that wearing a mask gives you low-grade infection. And therefore, you want a low grade because you'll have a lower viral load. And with a lower viral load, then it will stimulate the immune system in a proper way, and then you can develop immunity with it without coming down with a full-blown COVID. While he was giving this explanation of why we should wear masks, the station manager peeked his head in the door, and he said, he just said masks don't work, didn't he? He said they cause infection. I said, I know.
Yeah.
And I said, wait, that's your evidence, and that's what you're putting out, which... The host of the show, Bob Jones, piped in and said, well, then if it's low-grade infections we want to be exposed to, why aren't kids back in school?
Right.
Because they have low viral loads. And so if they catch it and get over it, then that lessens the vectors that spread the disease.
But backing up a sec, first off, a low-grade infection because you wore a mask doesn't even make any sense, because if you get one virus that gets into your body, it's going to replicate itself. So it's not that whether you have 1 or 5 billion, if somebody spits a loogie in your mouth and they have COVID-19, well, then maybe you have 5 billion, you know, viruses that hit your system. But I don't think that if you get one virus, that's enough to have an infection. So that's a strange argument to make.
But
I wanted to back up a sec. You started out by talking about how, you know, the history of medicine changes. You're a historian as far as looking at nutrition, the history of nutrition, the history of medicine. I know you're constantly reflecting what we knew in the past. A lot of things, even like we've talked diets before, ketogenic diets, things like that, that's not new. It's been around forever. There's people that researched it.
It goes back to the Bible.
Exactly. And so there's really, it's not new, but it's like we forget about it. And what's happening right now, when you talk about, you know, it didn't work for the Spanish flu and things like that, a lot of times what these organizations...
Didn't work for the plague.
Yeah, it didn't work for this. But what's happening, I think, in medicine is if you these organizations, they try to codify information. Say, okay, this is everything we know about this condition. And then over time, the data changes. Even diet, I mean, what we understand about diet has changed dramatically in the last 15 to 20 years. It's not new, but it's our understanding. And now what's happening is those organizations take so long to pivot that they become irrelevant over time.
It's true. Things in medicine are slow to change, but there's so much influence and so much money and so much turf war mm-hmm. involved in this, and so many free-swinging egos that I found out are involved in this. You know, if anyone who's been involved in research, a dirty little joke that goes around is, well, if you want to know the results of the study, tell me who sponsored it.
Right.
And tell me who's funding it, and mm-hmm. then I'll tell you the results. And that's the truth. I mean, the American Heart Association, when George McGovern came out with his USDA food pyramid to tell all Americans how to eat, based on low-fat, high-carbohydrate diets, the American Heart Association said, no, that's wrong. That's not what the science shows. He said, well, if you want continued funding from the government, this is what you'll promote.
Right.
And so guess what? The American Heart Association still promotes to this day low-fat diets, even mm-hmm. though they were originally said, hey, there's no scientific basis for this, and today there still isn't.
Right.
But that's what we're stuck with, because politicians made that decision and have co-opted the medical profession and the scientific community.
Well, it's funny that we started out this conversation on COVID by talking about masks. Man, we haven't even got to the areas where, I mean, the controversy about masks seems very simple, but man, now they got medications and things like that in the mix too.
Yeah, but I wanted to use this as a segue, because to me, this is, breeds a bigger issue here, because I brought up to this doctor on the radio, said, well, how about all the other studies that show no benefit? You know, the 2020 British Medical Journal, and I quote, face masks worsen breathing and can worsen a viral load, because if you want to activate a dormant virus, deoxygenate the system,
right?
And that dampens your immune system. So a decrease immunity, according to the British Medical Journal. And this is not the time to act without evidence. No random trials on COVID-19 have been used for masks. Then the British Medical Journal went on to talk about, in another article, 10 randomized controlled trials, no significant reduction of influenza with masks. Influenza is a virus.
Right.
And coronaviruses too, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Another article, 31 eligible studies, no evidence to support the use of masks for COVID-19. No public data supports the use of masks. Then in April 2020, CDC can find no data to quantify risk reduction from the use of masks. It's patently false to claim that wearing a mask reduces COVID-19. That's the CDC. Physically impossible for a mask to protect from viruses. Now that all came from the CDC publication. So what the heck are we doing? And to me,
you still have all the governments, the schools, everything. Everybody still feel. I guess they're. I'm not arguing.
Yeah.
I'm kind of understanding that it's like it feels like if you don't do something, they feel like they're not doing anything.
Right. But here's my problem mm-hmm. with all of this. Here's the medical profession holds themselves out as the reservoir for scientific data and knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
We are the torch, the guiding light that everyone should follow.
Right.
For health procedures and protocols, and we're the reservoir of knowledge. We have all are, you know, they build $500 million facilities like the Heart Institute up in Dallas.
Right.
To treat and prevent disease. Incidentally, heart disease rates are going up. That's a side note, sorry. We build these massive facilities. I go to the Spahn Lyceum every year, and they talk about raising money because they have all these new medical procedures with the robotic surgery and the microsurgeries and the laser surgeries, all these medical techniques and all the latest technology and all the imaging systems and the MRIs and the CAT scans and the new ultrasound imaging systems they have, the color ultrasounds and stuff. And we have all the medications that they have, like the new immunocheckpoint drugs. And to go through a round of treatment is $1 million.
Right.
These are high-powered drugs. And we got like the Harvoni and all these medications for Hep C.
Right.
It can be $60,000 to $100,000 to go through a treatment protocol with these drugs, these massive drugs. All these pharmaceutical companies with their trillion-dollar bankrolls and all the research and university studies and all this stuff. And the height of scientific knowledge and the best they can come up with to help protect you from a virus is wearing a face diaper. That's the height of medical knowledge you're going to tell people?
Right.
That's insane. That would be like me in 1944. I'm a captain in the Navy. And I'm at the Brooklyn shipyard, and I'm about to take control of the new Iowa-class battleship.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I'm going to go into battle against, with its full complement of guns and crew, and I'm going to go in against the Japanese Navy. I'm sitting there on the boardwalk there. I'm getting ready to take control of my ship. And I walk out there on the pier, and there's a sunfish with a 14-year-old pock-faced kid holding a Daisy BB gun. What do you think I'm going to be thinking about at that moment in time?
Right.
Not only is that less than worthless, I'm going to die.
Right.
Going out in something like that. I mean, yeah, the sunfish is kind of a boat, I guess. And a 14-year-old pock-faced kid is kind of a crew. And yeah, a BB gun is a gun, but that's worthless.
Right.
Wearing face diapers are worthless when you're dealing with a virus. So why don't we talk about things that can actually benefit you? Let's go into battle with the USS Missouri with its 16-inch guns.
Right.
Firing a 2,500-pound projectile 24 miles to blast anything out of the water that's coming to harm you.
Right.
That's what I want to do. Talk
the
about
full complement of the human immune system is what you're referring
dang,
to.
Yes. We have the answers. So let's talk about things that actually will benefit us and that we can use, not only to this, because you think we're not going to face stuff like this again. You're wrong. We're going to see this again and again. So,
hey, by the way, you mentioned, just for those listening, you listed off specific research. I'm going to take a copy of those and I'm going to put them in the show notes because this is one thing that I've talked about. You know, we talk about research a lot when we get together and chat about different medical topics. One of the things that drives me nuts is exactly what you just said. Hey, I personally don't like wearing a mask. Okay. I don't like wearing one. And I intuitively and my medical background teaches me that it's like probably not going to help me prevent anything. You're pointing out research that says it doesn't for various virus forms, but yet it's still a recommend. People are still doing it. The other day,
mandating,
and I'm still. You know, the CDC is putting out research. They're putting out things that say this doesn't help, that doesn't help. The other one of the things that I've noticed on COVID-19 is a lot of the companies, and these are lay people to some extent, but a lot of these companies are asking before you come in to the office, you need to have a negative COVID-19 test. Okay, fine. We're also getting specialties like Houston Medical Center, different specialty doctors there that are requiring two separate, you know, one, you have to be on a different day, a separate negative COVID-19 test before you come to their office. Okay. Well, many of these patients, like I had one the other day that needed to go get their treatment, said you have to have two negative COVID-19 tests. Well, the problem is the CDC has already told us it doesn't rule out COVID-19. First off, it doesn't mean you're infectious. Whether it's, if it's positive and you've already had COVID-19, it's been greater than 10 days, it doesn't matter whether it's positive or not.
And different labs give you different results, number one. And number two, even the article in the New York Times, when I was seeing 50 to 60% false positive rates, they were saying there was a 60% 60 to 90% false positive rates because of the way they do the test.
Right.
It's a it's a test where they do amplification.
Right.
And if you go more than 30 amplifications, you're going to start getting false positives because you'll get viral pieces or things that are
exactly.
biologically inactive. They're using 35 amplifications
right.
in these tests.
So you're just getting pieces of the fragments of the genetic material.
Right.
It doesn't mean, when they try
it
to do
mean
the...
It's an active virus.
I guess my point is that's why the CDC has told us after 10 days... They've done extensive testing on people. They don't grow live viruses out of people in the vast herd of people after 10 days. That's why
right.
the guidelines. But yet you still see even medical communities asking for these tests and multiple versions of it.
And if anyone contradicts what the government guidelines are, you're taking off social media, even if the science is right.
Right.
And the science, I've seen CDC put stuff up on their website, then an hour later pull it down and then put up something different that contradicted what they just put up.
Yeah.
So what's right here?
Yeah.
Right. So I want to get down to the foundational
yeah, absolutely.
Thing. So one of the things, I went to the CDC website, and let's look at the people that are most vulnerable to this disease. And on their chart, you know, if you're young, you know, it's an amazing statistic. The average people that are dying from this virus is older than the average life expectancy of the average American.
Right.
And that's a crazy statistic.
Right.
So who are the people most vulnerable? And you look at the chart, young and young adults, the mortality rate is practically zero.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, all of a sudden you see this large spike when you get to the elderly, when you get to 65 and older, all of a sudden you see this large spike, especially when you get into the 70 and 80 year old group.
But it's still greater than 75 is the highest group, isn't it?
Yes. So you all of a sudden you see this giant spike. So why are the elderly? The question is, what we're not asking, why is that the group that's the most vulnerable
right.
to this disease? Because you go to a lot of doctors and say, well, it's just because you're old. Well, man, if you go to a doctor and he tells you that, get a new doctor, please.
Exactly.
That's not just because you're elderly doesn't mean you should be sick and broken down.
Right.
That's ridiculous. So what I wanted to do, I went back and so I got another chart and I wanted to look at something called comorbidity in this. And comorbidities is what the CDC defines a comorbidity. And because they had to down-regulate the number of people that have died from COVID-19 by 94%.
Right.
Because only 6% of the people that they've reported, all these 200,000 people have died from COVID. Well, they had to downgrade that by 94%.
Mm-hmm.
Because only 6% of people that have actually died from COVID.
No, so, now tell me about that. Where are you getting that number?
Well, that from the CDC.
So what do you mean they downregulated?
Only 6% of people that have been classified have actually died from COVID itself. 94% have had comorbidities.
Got you. So give an example. This would be something like they had lung disease, heart failure, things like that.
Let's get into that. So that means only 9,000 to 10,000 people actually died from COVID.
Okay.
So everyone else had a comorbidity, and what the CDC defines a comorbidity. More than one disease or condition is present in the same person at the same time. Conditions described as comorbidities are often chronic and long-term conditions. So that's 94% of the COVID-19 deaths had underlying medical conditions. So let's look at the CDC. What were those underlying medical conditions? What were killing most people? Well, what was interesting when you start looking at the statistics, infection. People had the flu or pneumonia.
Right.
I was surprised at that. And incidentally, CDC says 60,000 people every year die from upper respiratory tract infections.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, can you imagine if they had COVID? Was it the COVID or was it the pneumonia that got them? And see, here's the problem with when you start looking at comorbidities. I have a friend whose mother just passed away. She was a horrible, uncontrolled diabetic, ended up having a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
So then she was confined to a wheelchair. And then she developed kidney failure. And then with that, put a tremendous stress on the heart. She developed a heart condition,
right.
Heart failure.
Right.
And then she contracted pneumonia.
Okay.
And she passed away. So guess what they put as a cause of death on her death certificate? Respiratory failure.
Mm-hmm.
Not pneumonia, because I've had pneumonia.
Right.
I recovered from it. Why? Because my immune system was strong enough to deal with it. Hers wasn't, because... You know, when you're in kidney failure and you're in heart failure and you're diabetic and you're bound to a wheelchair, you know, you've got some serious health issues.
It was a snowball of problems leading to that.
Yeah, it
was.
Had
to go upstream from the absolute cause of death.
Right. It wasn't the pneumonia.
Right.
That was the final straw.
Right.
And that's what we're doing and seeing with COVID. So people, number one, were infections. But here were some of the other interesting factors that I saw that I felt that were very interesting. Of course, diabetics, of course, in Corpus Christi, you know, that's half our population. And I was talking to some of my nurses, by the way, and I've been talking to quite a few in a lot of the hospitals here. And incidentally, we've had whole wards of nurses getting sick with COVID. They're all wearing masks, by the way. But they were showing me pictures of the patients that were in the wards that had COVID, that tested positive. And she said, you noticed anything about all these different patients? They're all fat and diabetic. Well, obesity was a huge factor
in
this.
Right.
Diabetes was a huge factor. Hypertension was a huge factor. Heart disease is a huge factor. Matter of fact, over 50% of all these individuals have coronary heart disease.
Right.
These are all metabolic diseases.
Inflammatory disorders as well.
Yes, and we're going to discuss that. So doctors, since these are all cancer, a metabolic disease, so are you doctors, are you telling people what causes metabolic disease? Are you telling them how to treat or prevent metabolic disease? Are you telling them about insulin resistance? And do you even know what insulin resistance is? Mm-hmm. If you're not, all you're telling people to do is wear a face diaper.
Right.
And you're not actually getting to the true crux of the problem. But let's first of all start with the number one thing that was get is ischemic heart disease. And the number one cause of ischemic heart disease, the number one heart condition in that umbrella is AFib.
Right.
And so I wanted to bring in a few statistics here. And this is in the journal Circulation. AFib is associated with cognitive impairment, which is not fully explained by stroke or other traditional cardiovascular risk factors. Furthermore, cognitive impairment is associated with poor clinical outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Hearing impairment is common and easily assessed among the elderly and may identify a subgroup with higher risk of cognitive impairment. Hearing impairment is prevalent and easily assessed and under-recognized factor associated with cognitive impairment in AFib patients. Screening of sensory impairment may be indicated among the AFib patients to identify individuals at high risk for adverse outcomes. And the reason I'm bringing this up in AFib patients is because how many times do you see hearing loss or cognitive loss in elderly people? And we just chalk it up to AFib.
Yeah, it's super common.
It's
right.
Super common.
We think it's supposed to happen when it's really not normal.
But that's actually, they're finding it's caused by AFib, other underlying metabolic conditions, which is a comorbidity for things like COVID.
Right.
So this is what that article was talking about. And the American Heart Association also says staying heart healthy after 65, what we need to know about AFib. Adults age 65 and older are at the highest risk for developing a dangerous heart condition called atrial fibrillation. When left untreated, AFib can increase your risk of having a stroke by 500%.
That's a lot.
That's ridiculous, and double your chances of heart-related death.
Right.
So some of the symptoms of AFib, a fluttering heartbeat, heart palpitations, lightheadedness, feeling winded while at rest, chest pain, and fainting. Now, why is this important? Well, COVID-19 is associated with tenfold increase in risk for arrhythmias and heart attacks. And this was on DocWire News. It says, early studies suggest that COVID-19 is associated with a high incidence of cardiac arrhythmias. And that was a Heart Rhythm Journal. COVID-19 associated with high prevalence of coronary vascular risk factors and mortality. 46% of patients had a history of coronary vascular disease, the most prevalent being coronary artery disease, heart failure, and AFib. And that was published in August 20, 2020. So we've known that for quite a while. Hearing loss and cognitive decline among older adults and AFib. And this was a journal of geriatric cardiology. So again, we're seeing these symptoms that are easily recognizable and are most doctors even paying attention to them. Annals of Internal Medicine, atrial fibrillation, AFib, has been linked with an increased risk for cognitive impairment and dementia. Evidence suggests that AFib is associated with higher risk for cognitive impairment and dementia with or without clinical stroke. Harvard, and this is how AFib may affect your brain. Now there's a growing recognition that people with AFib also face an increased risk of thinking and memory problems, even if they do not experience stroke. Known as cognitive impairment, these problems include trouble remembering, learning new things, concentrating, or making routine decisions. Until recently, very little was known about the association between AFib and cognitive impairment. Doctors, are we looking for this? Are we talking about this? And we know that it's associated. It's the largest comorbidity with COVID-19.
Right.
It's the largest comorbidity. And the thing is, what medical treatments do we have for AFib? Well, there's some really good data. And the first...
Well, let me stop you, though. Traditionally, Western medicine, and the way I'm trained, is if AFib is a quivering of the upper atria of the heart, we're taught, and the standard of care would be to first, what we do, we call rate control, which is try to make sure that the heart rate is, you know, in a reasonable range, it's not too fast, things like that. And then sometimes we can correct it with electrical conversion or chemical conversion. And then the other big factor is just treating with blood thinners, things like that, to keep you from having a stroke.
The
problem I have with that, which I would do if that's what a patient was sitting in front of me and they have AFib, I would try to treat them that. I would be obliged to treat them that way as a medical doctor. But I know where you're going with this, and this is what I'm waiting for, because one part of me says, okay, that's the standard of care, which says you have this symptom, treat that symptom. But the reality I wish we were asking more of as a medical community, well, what caused that?
All the standard of care means is what another doctor in your same situation would do in a treatment plan, whether it's right or wrong.
Right. These are the guys that are putting their name on your little placard, your little shingle that allows you to do your job. That's you know, the powers that be that we've
that's
set determined. Up to determine. But that's what I'm getting is... That's fine. We don't want people to have strokes. So if you have AFib and you're taking your blood thinner to keep you from having a stroke, great. But the question we should all be asking, and I wish we could get to in the medical community, is why is this happening?
Correct.
Just do we treat the symptom. Why is it happening, and can we treat that?
What's the pathophysiology?
Because that's what we should be asking about AFib.
Correct. And the thing I don't understand, what is science? We have a misunderstanding what science is. Science is a method.
Right.
Science is an observation of
it's a process.
Nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's a process. Exactly. That's all it is.
Right.
But the human body is the most amazing, elegant thing on this planet. Its ability to grow and reproduce and make energy, and the processes that go along, the biochemistry that goes on in our body, the way the nervous system works, the functioning of the brain, stuff we can't even explain, the whole microcosm that's within every cell of the body. It's the most amazing. And think about a woman. She can grow an entire human life within her body.
Right.
There's nothing in medical science that can come close to that.
Right.
We think we're so sophisticated with our medical science. No. The human body is the most amazing, beautiful, integrated thing on the planet. If you could take one teaspoon of DNA, its ability to store information. One teaspoon of DNA can store the entire knowledge of the world in a one teaspoon amount of DNA. It has that much storage capacity. There's nothing on this planet, no technology that could come close to what the human body can do.
Right.
But why do we think in our hubris that some chemical compound, some synthetic chemical, is going to heal the body when it was designed to take in nutrients? That's what it was designed, to take in food concentrates. That's what it was designed to do. So when you mention a healthy diet or lifestyle, people go freak out, and that's controversial.
Right.
Why isn't putting some chemical, crazy chemical, toxic compound into a natural living organism, why is that not controversial?
Yeah, and that's my point, is like I as a medical doctor realize that I have to treat a certain way because if they have that symptom, the risk is stroke or whatever, I must treat with this. That's what I'm getting at, though, is we then should be going on and saying, fine, you have this, we'll protect you for now, but what you need to be doing is figuring out how your machine is going to work better by re-nourishing it. That conversation rarely happens in most, you know, sort of offices, I think.
And I just pulled a few things off the shelf. I got a stack of these, but this is the Journal of Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. B vitamin deficiencies in hospitalized patients with with heart failure. And I have article after article in the top medical journals that we know B vitamins or deficiencies are associated with heart, AFib especially.
Is it certain ones or just general B vitamins?
Well, in this article it was general B vitamins, and they were talking about B1 and B2. Because one of the things that is not recognized by the federal government is one of the most important B vitamins responsible for the functioning of the heart is B4.
Right.
Now, the Canadian government recognizes B4 as necessary for proper heart function and the electrical conductivity of the heart. The FDA doesn't, because B4 cannot be synthesized. It can only be found in food.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. They don't recognize it as a necessary component for human health.
It just doesn't exist.
It just doesn't exist. If you can't synthesize it into a drug.
They can't isolate it, or they can't?
You cannot isolate
can't isolate it. It has to be tied to other compounds and a food natural complex.
That is correct.
Interesting.
So it doesn't exist. But, you know, here is an article written, and it was written by Dr. Edward Vetter. And this is a big-time doctor, guys. Vetter, and this is a book that's still in print.
Yeah, John is showing me a picture, a classic reprint series on Beriberi by Edward B. Vetter, V-E-D-D-E-R, Forgotten Books, it's called.
So Vetter, let me tell you who Vetter was. They used such a big deal that they named an entire wing of Walter Reed Hospital after Vetter. He was a researcher into nutritional deficiency diseases, especially Beriberi. Mm-hmm. And what Beriberi is, heart disease.
Okay.
Cardiac failure.
Yeah.
That's the hallmark of beriberi.
It's a nutritional cause of heart failure.
Yeah. So it's a B vitamin deficiency.
Right.
But they've done experiments in the past where they've given patients, because they know this and they've seen the work, and they'll give patients B vitamins, and it has no benefit on heart patients. Why? Because they're giving synthetics. Because they're isomers of the real thing.
Right.
There's chirality. And we know this in veterinarian medicine, because it's all the research. But we know that you can't give an isomer of something and have it have the same effect. It's like trying to put a right-handed threaded nut on a left-handed threaded bolt.
Right.
Even though they're identical, you can't get it to go on.
Right.
And that's what happens with natural versus synthetic vitamins. That's why when you take amino acids, for example, you always take L-carnitine or L-ornithine or L-lysine or one of these others, because only left-handed molecules are biologically active.
Right.
All synthetic vitamins are right-handed, or dextro molecules.
Right.
You have to have a levo molecule to be biologically active.
Yep.
And you can only find that in, guess what?
Food.
Yeah. Or food concentrates.
Right.
And here's what Vetter wrote. The infants, and this is out of his book, the infants we all given 20 drops of the extract of rice polishings every 2 hours while awake. And so the results have been truly marvelous. And he's talking about treating beriberi right now with infants. Improvement is immediate. The vomiting stops within 24 to 36 hours. The child has not passed any urine for several days, urinates 5 or 6 times freely. The edema disappears in the course of a few days, usually on the first night after treatment is begun. And that's treatment by giving them food.
Said rice washings? Is that what it is?
Rice polishings.
Polishings. What it was? Yeah, some kind of.
That's the husk on the rice.
The husk. Okay.
Yeah,
so it's
which is processed off.
Right.
So you don't get that in processed rice or processed foods.
Gotcha.
That's why when it's well documented that the biggest rise in heart disease was during the Industrial Revolution when we started processing grain.
Right.
And all of a sudden, heart disease.
So we're stripping up potentially. Building the case that we're stripping away vital nutrients from the food that was
correct.
There to begin with.
Yes.
And taking in empty calories.
So usually on the first night after treatment has begun, the infant falls into a deep sleep, although it may have been practically sleepless for several weeks. Dyspnea, which is difficulty breathing, and palpitations cease after 2 or 3 days. At the end of a week or in less time, the patients are completely cured. Completely cured. He says, it can be said that this extract is a cure in the true sense of the word, giving them food. He found he would give patients digitalis. He would give them artificial synthetic B vitamins. It had no benefit. He said digitalis will get keep the heart working for a while, because it's like beating a tired horse. You can stimulate it to keep going.
But it treats a symptom.
But it's eventually going to fall over dead.
Yeah, it's altering the electrical activity of the heart, so it's not really treating why it's happening.
Right. And this was an interesting article, and I got this. This was Dr. Royal Lee, and who was a very famous nutritionist back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And this was in a conference called the Annual Congress and Convention of International Association, and you love this, Liberal Physicians. This was a medical convention. Wow. And he gave this talk, and he said, a deficiency of the B complex is almost as devastating in its damage to heart mechanisms as is a deficiency of vitamin C complex. And why is vitamin C so damaging to the heart? Because remember what vitamin C deficiency disease is, hemorrhagic fever. Right. Scurvy, which is vascular breakdown, which is when your collagen starts to fall apart. That's how scurvy kills you.
Right.
It's vascular breakdown. The primary effect is to permit a relaxation of the vascular system. This is talking about B vitamins. Enlargement of the heart, atonia of the intestinal tract, and progressive degeneration of the nervous system with disturbances of heart rhythm. You got to remember, the heart is the most electrical organ of the body, more electrical than the brain. So that's very, very important that B vitamins play such an important part of the nervous system. And possible end results of heart block fibrillation. The heart enlargement often causes malposition of valves with consequence regurgitation. The administration of the B complex, which must contain the anti-paralysis vitamin in potent quantity, and the anti-paralysis vitamin is B4, will often temporarily eliminate the valve leakage, the skip beats, the fibrillation, or heart blocking, a phenomenally short time. In fact, cardiograms will show changes sometimes as quickly as within 15 minutes that are often hard to believe. It is certainly a barbaric practice to try to stimulate the heart with drugs under such circumstances. The correction of the deficiencies takes off the overload, which alone means that the vicious cycle is broken, and the improvement often is apparently miraculous even when the patient is on the brink of the grave. So when you nourish the heart, and it's amazing, I've seen this out with cows. You see a newborn calf, and it'll be laying there lifeless. And once it takes the first drink of its mother's milk, what's it doing? You've seen it bounding around the barnyard. It comes to life.
Right.
It's nourished, and those nutrients work that quickly. It's an amazing thing when you nourish a sick body.
So Royal Lee, this is written, decades and decades ago, is indicating evidence and research they've done where they've simply adding whole foods that contain B4 that reverses atrial fibrillation.
Yes, and well documented, and we have been for years, and better documented that, and you get a. Remember, these are no small fries. Now,
but cycling it back, the reason we're talking about atrial fibrillation and in turn these vitamin mineral deficiencies because they are the comorbidities that are highest associated with COVID-19 deaths.
Yes.
We're building the case that improving nutritional status very well could be beneficial for long-term risk factors for even having COVID-19 or getting sick, badly sick with it to begin with.
Yes. Why not treat and strengthen the body?
Right.
I don't understand what the problem with that is. And there's a great product on the market, and I'm going to talk about it. It's called Cataplex B Core, and it's a new product. It's been out since September. It's amazing. Some of the physicians that have been using Cataplex B for a while, and that go back to Royal Lee, some of the older physicians were complaining to the company that the Cataplex B wasn't working quite like it used to. Mm-hmm. And the company said, well, people just aren't as well as they used to be. They're not as healthy as they used to be, so they're not going to have the response. I said, no, there's something wrong. So they started doing some research on their Cataplex B, which is a whole food concentrate supplement.
Right.
But over the years, people in the lab have been adding a little of this or a little of that to improve the formula, apparently. Well, they went back, and they went back to the original Lee formula, which is more concentrated because it had fewer ingredients. Mm-hmm. Too many cooks in the kitchen sometimes spoiled. And they took 3 years to do clinical research on the effects that the new formulation had on the heart, and it was astounding. The ingredients of the new Cataplex B Core, the ingredients of this are liver, beet and carrot juice, nutritional yeast, and rice bran polishings, which is what Vetter used to cure beriberi. So here you have a beautiful whole food concentrate that has been clinically shown. And you can run a heart graph, which incidentally you can find in SIBA, you can find in Guide Medical Physiology. A heart graph recorder was an old medical technology that they used to look at heart function for years and years and years. I don't know why they don't use it much anymore.
Right.
But you can take a heart graph recorder, and with some patients, you can see within minutes changes in heart function.
Mm-hmm.
It is astounding. So this is something that's very, very important. And I wanted to, and I just pulled a few things off the shelf real quick because I was in a hurry. And it's not fat, because we're all stuck in this mode that it's fat and cholesterol causes heart disease. And here is an article from the American Diabetes Association. And it says, diabetics who are obese or who have received treatment with insulin have elevated insulin levels and, as a group, have an increased incidence of cardiovascular disease. Insulin in small concentrations has effects on arterial tissue, including stimulation of smooth muscle cell proliferation. That means you're thickening the vascular system. You're thickening
right.
the walls.
Right.
So insulin causes proliferation and also stimulates the proliferation of glucose that is incorporated into lipids. So yes, ladies and gentlemen, high blood fats are associated with sugar
right.
and insulin.
Right.
So what's causing the thickening of our arteries and blood lipids to build up in the blood? Carbohydrates and insulin. It is suggested that insulin has a role in the development of atherosclerosis.
Right.
And where is that? That was published in the American Diabetes Association Journal. How come they don't make recommendations?
What year was that?
That was in the year 1981.
Oh.
They knew that back in 1981.
Right.
And this is out of the Lancet. It says, association of fats and carbohydrates intake with cardiovascular disease and mortality in 18 countries. This was an 18-country study. And let me read. High carbohydrate intake was associated with higher risks of total mortality. Let me read that again. High carbohydrate intake was associated with higher risk of total mortality, whereas total fat and individual types of fats were related to lower total mortality. Total fat and types of fat were not associated with cardiovascular disease, myocardial infarction, or cardiovascular disease mortality. Whereas saturated fat had an inverse association with stroke, global dietary guidelines should be reconsidered in light of these findings.
What year was that, and what journal? Lancet.
That was in the Lancet.
Lancet's a very respected journal.
And
what year was that?
Let me find them. We can find the year published. That up in a second.
Yeah, it's okay. Associations of fats, carbohydrates. This is the thing that gets me, is like, you look, everything gets dumbed down at the level of practice. You know, when people, when they hear diabetes, there's, and you hear inflammatory disease and you hear heart disease, there's really well-written articles and research going way back that indicate there's a dietary component to this, but it's not the primary tool
yeah.
that people are using.
Yeah. 2015, this is the journal Cell Metabolism, insulin resistance is associated with systemic cardiovascular disease. We've known this for a long, long time now. And then another big component, another comorbidity that we're seeing with COVID-19 is of course, people with hypertension. More associated, people on hypertensive meds. Because hypertensive meds are very powerful heart drugs. They shut down the heart. And when your heart slows down, it can no longer pull fluid out of the lungs.
Right.
So your lungs start filling up with fluid. That's not. And then why are we giving all these hypertensive meds? And here we have a review in the journal Therapeutics. And it says, a review of Atenolol may be ineffective in reducing cardiovascular morbidity or all-cause mortality in hypertension. Atenolol, and we also have that in the British Medical Journal. Review, Atenolol may be ineffective in reducing cardiovascular morbidity or all-cause mortality in hypertension. So we're giving these very powerful heart drugs that actually have been shown to have no benefit. And just I didn't want to go over too much on cholesterol, but I just thought this was very, very interesting. And I wanted to point out that there's a lawsuit that was filed, and this was in CBS News, against Pfizer, because Pfizer docs ran the National Institutes of Health cholesterol education program. Now, you wouldn't know about this because when the drug reps for cholesterol meds used to come into to our office,
right,
where you work,
right,
they would always quote, you need to lower cholesterol because the National Institutes of Health guidelines say so. You would never stick around and listen to them.
Right.
You would never listen to the drug reps.
Right.
They said, I don't care what they have to say. I'm going to follow what the science
I was
said.
Taught that in medical school. My professors taught me they're salespeople. Don't listen to what they say.
Yeah.
Get your research somewhere else.
You're one of the few. Yeah. So we usually have to get somebody else to come in and listen to the
right.
sales pitch so we can
get
a free
lunch.
Yes. So you never heard this, but right. yes, we were always told the National Institutes of Health say, well, they were run by Pfizer.
Right.
Duh.
Right.
How good information do you think that you're going to get?
So let's pull back towards COVID.
Okay.
So you're making the case that there are nutritional causes to many of the highest risk problems that cause mortality
yeah.
with this virus we call COVID-19. You have made the case on atrial fibrillation
okay.
and the tie-in with beriberi.
Yes.
And the fact that
B vitamin deficiencies
is the core. And this and high carbohydrate diets, which is the reason for obesity and the diabetic topic. Insulin resistance, all the things you just mentioned in those articles from The Lancet, from professional dietary journals.
So
you're making this case, and you're even quoting people that knew this nearly 100 years ago
right.
or longer. We knew some of the back then they were using real ingredients and treating people and observing very real symptoms. So let's bring this back to COVID-19.
Let's go on. So let's talk now about another mortality group and something that's very related, the primary, and let's talk about anemia. So what is the primary function of hemoglobin? And this is very, very important. Hemoglobin is there to secure atmospheric oxygen and deliver it to the tissues of the body. So that's respiration. And just incidentally, this is... a really interesting quotation is, for the life of the flesh is in the blood. And that's Leviticus 17:13.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that statement is not FDA approved, by the way. So I just wanted to point that out. But this is why we're talking about the blood. Our life force is in the blood. And this is in the journal Hematologica. And it says anemia in the elderly, defined as people over the age of 65, is common and increasing in the population as the population ages. In older patients, anemia of any degree contributes significantly to morbidity and mortality and has a significant effect on the quality of life. Despite its clinical importance, anemia in the elderly is under-recognized and evidence-based guidelines and its management are lacking. All healthcare providers should include hematological and hematologists should be aware that anemia impacts a significant group within our society. It is an entity that lies within our ability to diagnose and treat. So why are we talking about this? And it says the prevalence, this is in the journal Clinical Medicine. Anemia was associated with significantly higher in-hospital mortality. Functional iron deficiencies were present in 80% of patients upon admission, linked to more advanced inflammation and associated with significantly longer hospital stays. The results of our study indicate that anemia, and specifically anemia of inflammation, is prevalent in patients with severe COVID-19 disease and is associated with an unfavorable outcome. And anemia predicts subsequent inefficient pulmonary oxygenation and with the need for ICU admissions and mechanical ventilations. So what we're saying is, why are patients needing ventilation? Because they're anemic. They don't have the hemoglobin. And that's why ventilators don't work, because all you're doing is moving around deoxygenated blood.
Right.
So we're not even looking at the prime
cause. And not
cause.
Only that, you know, they've got most of the stuff I've looked at regarding mechanical ventilation. The outcomes are not good.
No, if you're
on a ventilator, very high probability of not getting off of that with COVID-19 specifically.
Yes.
But what the issue often is if you've got someone that has anemia or lots of comorbidities, you have to basically try to force oxygen into them, and it damages the lungs.
Right.
And so then,
but they don't have the oxygen carrying capacity.
Exactly, because it's like they don't have the proper blood content to move the oxygen. Correct. So you're trying to make up with it with extra pressure, extra oxygenation externally.
What does a blood cell need to make hemoglobin? Iron.
Iron, yeah.
And all our elderly, and for a lot of reasons. Docs, what are you doing? You're giving patients antacids. Every other commercial I see on TV is for an antacid. Right. What is an antacid? Iron can only be absorbed in the stomach.
Yeah, it needs a strong acid, yeah.
And what are we eating today? Oh, don't eat meat. What's your number one source of iron?
Right.
Incidentally, meat. And we don't have the chompers to eat our green leafy vegetables. Or our right. source. So all of us, a lot of us are running iron deficiencies. Anemia is a huge problem.
John, I'm side note, but I've noticed that as folks get older, and this is important for the older folks because that's a high-risk population, I've noticed and I've read research that shows that the older people get, especially into the sixth and seventh decades of life, the natural high-powered stomach acidity declines, such right. that when you get into the seventh decade, you have about 10% of the natural stomach acidity you did when you were 18 years old. Okay. My question to you, do you know of any nutritional reason that would be going on, or is that merely a result of long-standing or just decline in natural function? Do you have any feel for that?
Oh, absolutely. Number one, we're taking all these acid blockers.
Well,
today,
yeah, there's
medication. Every other
chemical
person
reason,
that,
yeah.
that we know, we're taking acid blockers. I mean, that's every other commercial.
Right.
If you're elderly, man, they're all on. And what do doctors, I've seen doctors recommend Tums
right.
as a source of calcium.
Right.
Yeah, that's calcium carbonate. And the reason, calcium carbonate is limestone.
Right.
It soaks up all your stomach acid.
Yeah, it takes way more metabolic steps to absorb than just
so
basic
So we're taking
calcium
the wrong right type of calcium supplements on top of that. Every calcium supplement is oyster shell or calcium carbonate, which is limestone,
right?
Which actually kills our stomach acid, kills our digestive system. Plus the types of food you eat. You're eating, we're combining carbohydrates and proteins in the same meal.
Right.
Well, carbohydrates need alkaline to digest. Proteins need acid. Something's getting dominated.
Right.
That you just messed up your digestive process. So
right.
We're poor food combining. Plus you need mineral salt. You need salt to make stomach acid. We're all on these low sodium diets.
Another, with the elderly, a lot of them will say, I just can't eat meat anymore. And that's a great point you made about the acidity. Often their acidity is declining, so then they don't tolerate.
Yeah.
When they do get a chance at a good, high-protein, good-fat meal, they don't absorb it very well because their acidity is low.
And the other reason they can't absorb fat is, number one, they've had a gallbladder ripped out, or number two, they have liver congestion. They've been taking Tylenol, things like that, which destroy liver function.
Right.
It's a liver poison, huge liver poison. So those are the things. So you don't have gallbladder function, which is there to digest fat.
Right.
So there's so many components in this. And if you're eating a high amount of carbohydrates or alcohol or taking medications, you're causing liver congestion. Your liver is now making sludge instead of bile. And so you're not digesting fat. So there's so many causes in this.
Where do you think the point, when I hear this, and where do you think the point of no return is? I know there's people out there that might listen to this and think, well, I'm 75 and I've got digestive issues, and if I don't take my Tums or my Protonix or my Omeprazole, I'm going to have a problem. And I understand what you're saying, doctor. I'm anemic. I might be at risk. But what's the point of no return?
And when they're throwing dirt on your face.
Okay.
For me, I mean, you try to the moment they take their last breath, you try.
Because you never know what the machinery can do when nourished properly.
You never know. Miracles happen.
Yeah.
The body is a miracle. Life is a miracle. And this was in the published by Northwestern University, a fairly prestigious university. Compared to influenza, patients with COVID-19 exhibited a continued increase in white blood cell count and rapid decline of hemoglobin, which you just talked about, discussed. And why is that? Iron deficiency. This was in the JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association. Iron deficiency anemia is associated with hearing loss and the adult population. Well, this is interesting. Again, hearing loss. We're associating hearing loss and fatigue and mental sluggishness, which is old age. And these are real-life nutritional deficiencies we need to be looking at and recognizing, and we're not doing that. This was in The Lancet. Anemia affects 33% of the world's population, and about half the cases are due to iron deficiencies. Clinicians should also consider iron deficiency anemia and several pathological disorders notably chronic kidney disease, chronic heart failure, cancer, and inflammatory bowel disease. So some of the symptoms of anemia: pallor, fatigue, headaches, dyspnea, labored breathing, dry and rough skin, dry and damaged hair, alopecia, spoon-shaped fingernails, and atrophic glossitis, which is smooth tongue. Iron deficiency anemia has a negative effect on physical performance, especially on work and productivity, and on cognitive function, both for children and elderly people. Again, cognitive function associated with this. Again, associated with the elderly when it's usually a metabolic problem. This is in the European Journal of Epidemiology. Anemia and Iron Metabolism in COVID-19, a systemic review and meta-analysis. Iron metabolism and anemia may play an important role in multiple organ dysfunction syndromes and coronavirus disease. Hemoglobin levels were lower with older age. Higher percentage of subjects with diabetes, hypertension, and overall comorbidities and admitted to intensive care. This is Transfusion and Apheresis Science, that journal. Anemia is associated with severe coronavirus disease. Patients with anemia should hence be advised to take extra precautions to minimize risk exposure to the virus. Physicians should be engaged in close monitoring of anemic patients with suspected COVID-19 for timely detecting signs of disease progression. Finally, the presence of anemia shall be regarded as an important factor in future risk stratification models of COVID-19.
But rather than just risk stratify them, why the question in my mind, big question mark, is why isn't the recommendation to aggressively try to renourish?
That's a good question, because they don't know how. And we'll discuss that in just a second, too. This was published by Oxford, the Oxford Academic Journal. Serum iron levels as a potential predictor of coronavirus. So this was interesting. Decreased serum iron levels could predict the transition of COVID-19 from mild to severe and in critical illness. 54% of patients with lower serum iron levels after treatment in the critical care group died. So it's a predictor of how severe this disease is going to be and how it's going to affect you. There was a significant difference in post-treatment of serum iron levels between COVID-19 survivors and non-survivors. Serum iron deficiencies was detected in the patients with COVID-19. The severity and mortality of the disease was closely correlated with serum iron levels. Low serum iron concentration was an independent risk factor for death in COVID-19 patients.
I've seen a few early on when they were looking at acute phase treatment for COVID-19. I saw early on several doctors that were advocating screening things like ferritin and total iron binding capacity and things like that because of probably that very research.
Now here's the deal. You have to have iron in a form you can absorb. And this was in the European Journal of Nutrition. And you know this, and you preach this a lot. Lactic acid fermentation is one of the oldest methods of preserving food. It is becoming increasingly popular since the fermentation increases the nutritional value of food and the consumers perceive it as a natural and free of food additives. Lactic fermentation of food increases the availability of iron. Yep. It has to be in a lactic acid form, as shown in numerous studies. The mechanism for the increased bioavailability of iron from lactic fermented vegetables is likely an effect of the increase of ferric iron species caused by the lactic fermentation.
So we're talking about kimchi, real sauerkraut,
kombucha,
things like that.
Whole milk, yogurt,
kefir,
vinegar, those kinds of lactic. This is important, and this is going to be really important in our next discussion. Now, there's a great...
Oh, and by the way, guess what? A lot of those foods, well, they're all acidic.
Yes.
Because lactic acid only grows in an acidic environment, which what we were just pointing out from a nutritional standpoint, from a digestive standpoint, how do you absorb iron? You must have an acidic environment.
You must have an acidic environment.
So eating those foods, those are natural sources of both acidity, plus probably the bacteria have a great deal to do with it. And then that creates the environment where your actual and your GI tract can actually absorb the minerals and whatever you're eating.
And they know this in animal nutrition. You notice... when plants take in minerals, they take in inorganic minerals, they convert them into an organic source by chelating them.
Right.
And so when they take a chelated mineral, That's already been processed for you in a form that you can utilize. When you eat an animal or a plant, you've already taken the inorganic mineral and processed it. Most forms of iron on the market are inorganic. That's why they give you stomach ache or make you constipated when you take them. Your body can't use them.
Right.
That's why when you see an animal feed, they always use chelated minerals in animal feeds.
Right.
Because they're absorbable by the animal. But usually a lot of companies are going to use the cheapest method possible. But you want a good natural food source. And there's a great product on the market. It's called Farafood by Standard Process. And look at the ingredients of this. Bovine liver. Why? Because it's a huge source of B12, and it's a huge source of iron. Bovine bone. Where are red blood cells made? Lung bone.
Right.
So you're stimulating the making of it. You have bovine spleen. What does the spleen do? It regenerates. It refurbishes our red blood cells because the body's very efficient. So we're supporting that system by the use of that supplement. It has porcine stomach parenchyma.
That's the lining of your stomach, yeah.
Yes, but why is that important? Why is it has porcine parenchyma? Because the parenchyma not only makes stomach acid, it makes intrinsic factor. And you cannot absorb iron without intrinsic factor.
Right.
So it gives you that factor so you can actually utilize.
Which is the cause of pernicious anemia, which is yet another condition related to B vitamin deficiency.
Correct.
Yeah.
It also contains camu berry. Why is that important? Because vitamin C is responsible for the maturation of your red blood cells, mm-hmm. or B12. So without vitamin C, you can't absorb iron. And what's the number one source of any food on the planet in vitamin C is camu berry. Believe it or not. And that's all in.
I've never heard that. Camu berry?
Yes. That's really? The number one sort and a Cirilla cherry.
You get so that from Kathmandu, or where does that come
that's
from?
That's what I would like to know.
I don't see that in the HEB grocery aisle.
No. So Farafood is a tremendous, it's got a more whole food C complex than any vitamin C on the market.
Wow.
In Farafood.
Right.
And it's in a ferrous lactate form. It's a lactic acid.
What about
iron.
If a person doesn't absorb iron very well? Let's say they're on antacids and things like that. They're not going to absorb. They're still going to even have trouble absorbing that.
Yeah, but it's still got all your intrinsic factors.
At least it's there,
and
one
it's
that
in
you
an acidic
absorb.
Form.
Right.
So this is a biologically active iron all its other cofactors.
Yep.
So tremendous. So we have products on the market. Now this, to me, this is the coup de grace of all the things we've been talking about today. As we said, one of the major comorbidities of when you're dealing with COVID-19 is infection. And what is a part of the immune, what is the mineral that is used in every aspect of immune function is calcium.
Right.
And calcium is critical. And that's one reason we run a fever. And it's not, you need 101, 102 degree temperature is not enough to kill anything. And put your finger in 102 degree water. It's lukewarm. At best, the body's trying to heat up the bone to release calcium into the system. Because the body takes calcium, and that's what it marks pathogens with. It actually goes to mark, and that's what phagocytes know to destroy. And so calcium is a marking agent. It's used in every aspect of immune function. And so this is was published in the journal Gastroenterology, August 1977. Dietary calcium inhibits the intestinal colonization of salmonella and other bacteria. Journal Leukocyte Biology, 2020. Ionized calcium levels were associated with leukocyte activity, susceptibility to infection, renal failure, and diabetes. Archives of Internal Medicine, it's 87. Low ionic calcium levels were documented in critically ill patients, including those with sepsis and shock. They are also had significantly higher temperatures. International Journal of Food Microbiology, 2008. Calcium lactate as a food additive was shown to dramatically reduce the ability of E. coli to survive. Journal Circulation, 2008. Post-operative hypocalcemia, low calcium levels, have been associated with paresthesias, tetanus, seizures, and arrhythmia. And going back to that. Journal of Pediatrics, and this is 1989. Ionized. Hypocalcemia is common in severely ill children, and patients with ionized hypo-low calcium levels have higher mortality rates than those with normal calcium levels. Journal Cell Biology, 2003. Exposure of cells to viruses results in rapid and transient increase in ionic calcium. Scandinavian Society of Anesthesiology and Intensive Care Medicine, 2003. Ionized hypocalcemia is common among critically ill patients and has been shown to correlate with increased mortality. American Journal of Medicine, and this is 1998, decrease in ionized calcium levels is very common abnormality in acutely ill patients and is associated with poor outcomes. Microbiology Pathogenesis, 1997, neutrophil-mediated killing of mycobacteria is a progressive and dependent on ionized calcium. And again, I keep emphasizing ionized calcium. We'll see why in a moment. Professional Medical Journal, 2006, low serum calcium levels has a definite role in the development of tuberculosis. Now, why is that important? Tuberculosis is the oldest infectious disease known to man. It's killed more people than any other disease in history.
Consumption.
2000, this was the journal Cell Biology. This is 2004. Eucerius pestis must survive inside a low temperature, high calcium flea. So it's trying to survive so that it can infect a high temperature, low calcium human cell. International Journal of Critical Illness and Injury Science, and this is 2014. Low blood calcium levels have been demonstrated to increase susceptibility to dengue fever and can be a predictor of its severity. So if you have low calcium levels, you're not going to have as good outcomes. Bioscience Reports, 2002. Phagocytosis and phagosome maturation are regulated by calcium. Cell calcium, the journal Cell Calcium. Oxidase activation in individual neutrophils is dependent on calcium concentrations. Journal Science, 86. Calcium levels are associated with the activation of Epstein-Barr virus. Indian Journal of Health, Science and Biomedical Research, 2019. Hypocalcemia, low calcium, is prevalent in children who develop dengue fever, and ionic calcium is a biomarker that can predict the severity of the infection early. Ionic calcium. Clinical Chemistry and Laboratory Medicine, 2020. Those patients who were admitted to the emergency room with the symptoms of SARS-CoV-2 were found to have a reduction in serum total calcium and whole blood actually ionized calcium levels.
That's important. Yes. Similar virus.
Yes.
Same family.
Critical Care and Emergency Medicine, 2020. Serum calcium was associated with clinical severity and prognosis of patients with COVID-19. International Journal of Basic and Clinical Epidemiology, 2020. Hypocalcemia is highly prevalent and predicts hospitalization of COVID-19. More patients with Ebola virus reported the same thing.
Right.
Amazing. What is the commonality in all these infectious diseases? Low calcium levels. World Applied Science Journal, 2009. Low serum calcium levels were identified in patients with acute gastritis. Department of Medicine, Washington Hospital Center, 2018. Ionized hypocalcemia is common in patients with sepsis. Life Science, 2016. Lactate calcium salts affects the viability of colorectal cancer. Again, an immunodeficiency disease, cancer. Food Navigator, 2001, calcium lactate may affect the survivability of salmonella, whereas calcium citrate and malate had little effects, say researchers at the University of Georgia. So why am I talking about this? Calcium lactate is the free calcium in the blood. And they said, looking at total calcium levels, and we can see this in veterinarian studies, looking at total calcium levels is not predictive, because total calcium level is bound calcium. You have to look at ionized calcium levels.
Right, which this calcium level that most doctors order, and I do the same thing, a complete metabolic panel shows total calcium, serum calcium. It doesn't look at ionized calcium. That's a separate test that has to be ordered separately.
And what they're talking about is what converts to ionized calcium, calcium lactate.
Right.
Lactic acid calcium.
Right.
One step. That's the only form of calcium that will convert. Citrate, malate, and definitely not calcium carbonate, which is rock, will not have that effect. What did calcium lactate? In animal studies, Veterinary Clinics of North America, Small Animal Practice, very prestigious journal. Measurements of serum total calcium has been relied on as assessment for calcium status, despite the fact that it is the ionized calcium fraction that has biological activity. Serum total does not accurately predict ionic calcium status and may in many clinical conditions. For accurate assessment of ionic status, ionic calcium should be directly measured. The Journal of Veterinary Medicine. In dogs, ionized hypocalcemia was predictive of sepsis and longer hospital stays. Journal of Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care. Ionized hypocalcemia is a prognostic indicator in dogs following trauma. Dogs with lower ionic calcium levels have lower survival rates. American Journal of Veterinary Research. Canine distemper virus associated with hypocalcemia. Journal of Veterinary Medicine and Critical Care. Incidence of low ionized calcium levels in septic dogs. So even if you see this in animal studies and some other things as a side note, just kind of wrap things up, you know, obesity is also a key factor in COVID-19 fatalities. And you're seeing obesity doubles one's risk of hospitalization and increases one's chances of death 4 to 12 times depending on one's level of obesity.
Right.
And we're seeing some places around the world, like Mexico, started banning junk food because they recognize this and realizing.
That might be one of the smartest things a government has done.
Could do. I know.
I did not hear that. And that's fascinating, because I walk through the grocery store and I see the crap that's for sale on the aisles and on the end aisles and all the everywhere in between, and it's offensive to me knowing that I know what you're saying. When I hear you just rattle off about 300 studies that show how calcium and basic iron and basic nutrition is leading to immune suppression, immune issues, breakdown of organ systems, and they're selling things that are stripped down, no nutritional value to it all. Purely dense in carbohydrates or processed
fats. What crashes the immune system? Number one, we eat sugar. Sugar crashes the immune system.
Right.
Devitalized food. You want to help someone out, tell them to quit drinking soft drinks. Quit eating breakfast cereals.
Right.
We're giving people antacids, which crashing. We're giving people antibiotics. They got a virus. So you give an antibiotic, which crushes your microbiome. 85% of your immune system is in the gut. James Allison, the Nobel Prize winner for his development of amino checkpoint drugs. He said, if you're treating someone with an amino checkpoint drug and put them on an antibiotic, it's 100% fatality rate.
Wow.
Your microbiome is that important and that vital and the immune function. And we're handing out antibiotics like candy.
Right.
We're crushing, we're doing that. We put people on statin drugs. And there was over 24 studies on COVID and vitamin D. The importance, because vitamin D modulates immune function. And what do statins do? They block vitamin D production. They also lower immune function.
Right.
So we're giving medication, and we're putting people on biologic medications.
Yeah, and the vitamin D being low is another thing. I think it's 88% of the case fatality rates for COVID-19. 88% have low vitamin D.
And there's 24 studies showing that.
Yeah, which is also an epidemic, and another pandemic is the low vitamin D levels, and which probably. Same issue we're talking about, just a different aspect.
Absolutely. The National Institutes of Health talk about the importance of zinc. Zinc inhibits viral reproduction. And that's one of the reasons hydrochloroquine is effective, they show, because it allows cell permeability to zinc.
Right.
And so, but zinc, the national, they've published that, how important zinc is. And we're, doc, are you talking about that? Are you giving whole food C complex? What activates phagocytosis? Vitamin C.
Right.
But it has to be, it's not ascorbic acid. See, the problem with ascorbic acid is an antioxidant. Because plants, think about what plants do. They do this thing called photosynthesis. But this photosynthesis for them produces this horrible waste product that they're desperately trying to get rid of. It's called oxygen. Yeah, they're shutting that off. So they're making massive amounts of antioxidants to protect themselves. The antioxidants aren't for our benefit.
Right.
The problem is antioxidants are what their name implies. They're antioxygenating.
Right.
They're not for us. So vitamin C must be in a whole complex. It must contain the bioflavonoids to be biologically active.
Means it comes from food. It comes in a complex from food. That's
from
the
food.
Way nature made it, not a chemical substrate that says 8,000 units or whatever on the side of it. Yeah.
So we're not talking about any of this. We're talking about people should be wearing a face diaper.
So let's talk about a specific... If patient A sitting in front of you, and they want some action steps. What is your go-to right now? If you had to list off a few things that I'd like you to do this dietarily, and I'd like you to do these supplements and these doses, what are you going to tell them?
Absolutely. Number one, if you have an elderly patient that walks in the door, they're tired, fatigued, run down, the first thing you need to put them on is Ferrafood. That should be a number one go-to for every doctor in town. But also, we have to recognize we need to get people off as many medications as possible. If someone comes into your office and they have hypertension, instead of putting them on a hypertensive drug that all that does is a Band-Aid, ask the question, what's causing the hypertension? Because one of the hugest, biggest comorbidities of COVID-19 or any infection is being on hypertensive drugs, which slows down heart function. So you've got to look at that. But for me, if right now, I'm worried about COVID-19. I've got COVID-19 and or a low immune system. You got to cut out sugar. You got to cut out soft drinks. You got to cut out breakfast cereals and genetically modified products. You need to go, and it sounds controversial, high-fat, adequate protein diets. You have to go back to eating whole foods, full-fat meat, full-fat dairy, cheese, nuts and seeds, pecans, almonds, walnuts, pure water. Water is crucial to the functioning of our systems. You got to get sunlight, movement, activity. What stimulates the immune system is activity. Very important to go out walking, getting some sun. Vitamin D is very important. Where do you find vitamin D? In animal fat. These are very crucial factors. Whole food C complex is very important because it activates the immune system. Calcium.
You're talking about something like calcium, cataplex C.
Cataplex C is very, that's a great source. Cyruta Plus. But cataplex C specifically is for immune function. Cyruta Plus is for microvasculature, which we see a lot of problems with people with COVID and vascular breakdown.
So yeah, I use that to support patients that are having, I get a lot of patients, elderly patients that have the breaking capillaries in their skin and things like that. And even if they're not on aspirin, sometimes you'll see that as well. And I tend to add that and it helps quite a bit.
Zinc chelate, because it's very important because it decreases the ability of virus to reproduce. And of course, vitamin D, I love it in the form of cod liver oil because it has the natural fats in it and it's highly absorbable. Because fat is the vehicle for D into the tissues.
Right.
So that's and I've done that with so many patients who've been tested positive and they were out mowing their lawn the next day.
Right.
And they've done just exceedingly well. Now, but get off the antacids. You need to get off the acid stopper, off the antibiotics. You know, why are you treating a virus as an antibiotic?
Yeah.
And I've seen also docs, you got to quit doing the steroids. It's just a reflex reaction. You get COVID, they put you on a steroid.
Right.
What do steroids do?
Yeah.
They crash the immune system.
Right.
I've seen so many people.
Especially with prolonged.
Crash right after they start a oral steroid.
Yeah.
If you're going to use it, nebulize them onto the tissue, onto the lung where they're needed. Not do it systemically.
This would be kind of like the budesonide therapies and things like that. When I've actually treated patients with COVID-19 that had some significant respiratory symptoms, wheezing, tightness, breathing issues, not quite hypoxic where they're losing, they might need to be in the hospital, I'll often use the budesonide, which is kind of an inhaled steroid with a bronchodilator in it. It tends to help. Most of those patients have done really well with that.
Because you're actually treating the issue and not treating systemically.
You know, one thing I will say,
burning down your house to kill the rats in the attic.
Yeah, one thing I will say about physicians treating this, I think there's a lot more awareness to just not throwing an antibiotic at everything. I think there's more awareness. I've always been aware of that, but patients have this expectation, oh, you're not doing anything if you don't give me an antibiotic.
Right.
Well, actually, we're a lot more clear now. No. You have COVID-19. It's a virus.
Right.
It doesn't, antibiotics don't help. In fact, I think it was the Henry Ford study. You know, everybody quotes about HCQ and hydroxychloroquine, it's so effective and all these things. In the treatment arm that included hydroxychloroquine, it did show a decrease in overall case fatality rate.
Right.
However, add Zithromax to that,
right,
and it went up by 5%. Went from 18 to 23%. That's adding an antibiotic to something that probably wasn't necessary and has these negative effects on mineral and vitamin absorption in your gut.
Hydrochloroquine, you want to really raise its effectiveness at zinc.
Right, of course, because that's part of its mechanism. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
So there's a missing factor. But when you say you're aware, you are very aware because you've been involved in, because you don't care, you're the type of physician, you don't care whether it's a medication, whether it's a whole food concentrate, whether it's acupuncture, chiropractor, whatever, as long as it's beneficial to the patient. You don't care where it comes from.
Right.
You're in that. But a lot of physicians don't think that way.
It's just not a tool. I mean, I'm not knocking my colleagues. It's just not their tool. And I hope that, you know, some docs are going to hear this and they're going to say, man, what is all this? Let me tell you, there's a massive pile of research laying on the floor that we just blew through from journals that I know I was taught in medical school to respect. JAMA, Lancet, all of these journals and more that you mentioned. And you talked about very real research that ties medical problems that we, you know, most cases of AFib, you know, just going back to that, most right. of those cases that come in, they just happen. Like,
right.
in other words, what I'm getting at is I see this patient that walks in to see me and, oh, I'm dizzy and I'm weak, and I check them and I identify they have AFib. Great, let's do the treatment. Let's go. But then in the back of my head, I'm kind of scratching my head thinking, but why do they have AFib? They're 55 years old.
Right.
Why do they have that? Well, we don't know. It just happens electrically, blah, blah, blah. No, it's not that. There's research going back 100 years that show there are real vitamin and mineral deficiencies. Again.
And it explains the etiology of why.
It does. And it's not, you know, and so this is interesting because, you know, I know you.
And I know the medical, I don't mean to be critical because they have their licenses on the line. And I know doctors who will prescribe hydrochloroquine. The pharmacist won't fill it. The CDC will not approve it, or the FDA will not approve it. I mean, they put people and doctors who have spoken out about it have lost their job.
Right.
I get that. I mean, I'm not really critical of individual docs. They're doing the best they can within the system
right.
they're given. It's going to be up to us patients to be educated, and we're going to have to change the system.
Yeah, and even this, I'll tell you, John, I mean, you make very compelling arguments based on very good research. When I hear, hey, you know, and be careful, don't take these medicines and stop your blood pressure med, as a physician, I am not advocating that because I don't know their individual spot. A person can have hypertension that their blood pressure is so high, I see people that get off of them and they stroke out because they're so sick that their compensation mechanisms of their high blood pressure makes them sick. But why are we not coming back and saying, no, 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 now let's nourish you and see if we can reverse this.
Right.
That's the way I like to approach it.
I think we need, brought up a great point, and I don't advocate if you're on blood pressure medication, don't stop taking your blood
right.
pressure. My point is go sit down with your doctor and say, I would like to get off this. What plan of action can we do to help me do that?
Right. And again, I think it's very reasonable as a medical doctor that we should be talking to patients about minimizing medications or not taking them at all. We have to do that safely because the medicine's got there for a reason. There often is a reason to treat AFib. If you don't treat AFib and it's out of control, your heart rate's 180, you're not going to live very long.
Right.
Okay, so it's a problem. So you do have to treat that. But I think this should be, if I were a physician, open-minded physician, I would hear this and say, man, I didn't realize there was so much. I mean, I realized, but there's a lot of physicians that might not realize the depth and the extent of research in journals from respected journals that is out there that we are not exposed to typically in medical school.
Well, hopefully I'm just helping physicians put more tools in their toolbox.
Yeah, that's what they need. It needs to be another tool. For me, John, you were kind of, you know, the choir echoing, you know, chamber here, but because I already use this as a tool in my practice. This is the ideal for me is I identify, because I get a lot of people that I just inherit patients that come to see me.
Right.
I'm like, well, so you're on, no joke, like 22 medications. I'm like, what are the odds that you're in any, you know, reasonable health at all? Very low. And and so what I get is I get a lot of that, and I find that my biggest job is to try to remove things that are absolutely unnecessary. I typically start exactly like you said. I'll come in and say, listen, we need to try to improve your digestion. We probably don't need all these antacids. Let's try a trial of increasing the strength of your acidity. Whole food diet, live culture foods,
digestive enzymes,
probiotics. And then a lot of times, then they're absorbing better. If we get them there, then their gut is healthier. Then they can absorb other nutrients and minerals and vitamins.
And their immune system can come online.
I would love to get to that place where, like, I wish it was a protocol right now. It is for me, but if it was a protocol for all doctors, yes, treat atrial fibrillation, and then let's identify the secondary and tertiary causes of this condition, which could include, you know, and boom, 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 and we go through all these, not the vitamin and mineral deficiencies due to a long-term poor diet, malnutrition, that's where we should be going, so that we can now say, and look, this patient has a spontaneous resolution of atrial fibrillation or strengthening of ejection fraction of their heart because they have been taking these nutrients and re-nourishing their system. Maybe we can stop the blood thinner, maybe we can, you know, and then work the other direction.
A healthy body doesn't need synthetic chemicals.
Exactly.
And so your job is to restore that patient to homeostasis.
Yeah.
And why can't a heart heal as a muscle?
Yeah.
Why can't you nourish it? Why can't it heal? It can.
Yeah.
And well, depending on the amount of damage that's been done to it. I mean, there's caveats there, of course.
Yeah. But John, we better wrap this one up. This has been another roller coaster of research and high energy, high impact. What I like about this, although it started as a COVID topic, much like the human body, it's not as simple as just, because a lot of people ask me, what supplements do I take so I can prevent COVID-19 or what do I treat with COVID-19?
Right.
It's not that simple. It's the body as a whole. And I think you did a good job of going through and explaining how some of these minerals, vitamins, and nutritional issues that the modern society is plagued with, how that's impacting real medical conditions that people suffer with, that is leading to susceptibility to case fatality with COVID-19. I think it's powerful.
So I hope that gives us at least some tools to go into battle. Instead of with a dinghy, we can go into it with a battleship, fully armed and ready to go.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to close just by saying that, again, for my part, this is, you know, obviously for informational purposes.
Right.
I love the idea that we're expanding people. If there's more people thinking and reading and researching, if we spurred your thought, then we've been successful, I think. If we're getting you to ask tougher questions of your physician, not because they're bad people,
and
work with them, this is the goal. It's not to have you toss your meds out the window or whatever. It's to get people to understand there's more depth to the discussion than simply just take this and you're done. So, John, I appreciate you coming in. I know you're going to be doing consults at our home clinic here soon, so I look forward to that. And definitely, if this interview was interesting to you, helpful, please leave a note in the show notes or leave a comment for us on Stitcher, iTunes, or even a review. We look forward to any questions also in the Future Focus Health Network. So, John, we'll close on that note.
Thanks, sir.
All right.